Hello, and welcome to the Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Boris Effects. I'm Steve Holfish. I'm a working film, TV, and documentary editor. Over the last 10 years, I've done more than 400 interviews with the world's best editors. Welcome to episode 14 of season 10. I've been using Boris Effects products for 30 years, and I'm proud to partner with them to bring you some great filmmaking content. Today on Art of the Cut, we're talking to the winner of the Indie Spirit Award for Best Editing, Daniel Garber, and his work on the film How to Blow Up a Pipeline. Daniel's other work includes the feature film Cam, which was also a collaboration with his Pipeline director, Daniel Goldhaber. Daniel has also worked in documentary editing in films like Some Kind of Heaven and the documentary series Naomi Osaka. He was also an additional editor on the Sundance documentary Riotsville, USA, which we featured on Art of the Cut several years ago. Before I hop into our discussion with Daniel, a brief thank you to our partner, Boris Effects. I've been using Boris Effects and Sapphire for 30 years, so they're not just a sponsor to me. I feel like they've been a partner in my cutting room for decades, helping me to deliver on the creative vision of my clients, directors, and producers. For all of us, our work is about bringing a creative idea to the screen, and for me, Boris Effects is one of the important tools that I use to do that. To see how they can help you on your latest project, head on over to borisfx.com and check out the Boris Effects suite, which includes Sapphire, Continuum, Mocha Pro, Silhouette, and Optics, all in a low-cost monthly or annual subscription. If you want to read this interview with great visual support, you can go to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC. That site also has other great filmmaking content, so keep that bookmarked. And now, Daniel Garber discusses editing How to Blow Up a Pipeline. Daniel, thank you so much for being on Art of the Cut. It's a pleasure meeting you, and I love the movie.
Thank you so much. I've been such a fan of the podcast for ages, so it's such a pleasure to actually be here on the show.
Well, thank you so much. So this movie came out a while ago, but the reason why I thought that we should chat is because you received, if I'm correct, the Indie Spirit Editing Award for this
movie. That's right.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a little bit surreal, but you know, it's always such a strange thing with awards shows because people are talking about these films so long after you've actually finished working on them. So it's like being transported back into a past life.
Yeah, I get that from a lot of editors. They're like, I've done two other projects since this one came out, so I don't, right, or since I edited at least. To start talking about the project itself, tell me a little bit about, if you can remember, the pre-title sequence of scenes. Was that scripted, and was there any thought for you of rearranging the order? It's basically you're being introduced to all the characters. Could have gone in any order, but it went in a certain order. Why?
That's a great question. I mean, honestly, I think that the script set me up for success in a lot of ways. That was actually apparently one of the very first things that they wrote. I think Ariella, who's one of the co-writers of the film, conceived of that opening sequence, sort of introducing each of the characters one by one. I think the order ultimately did not really change. We certainly toyed with that and didn't feel like we were constrained to what was in the script. But actually the thing that mostly changed was the duration of each of those little vignettes introducing each of the characters. Some of them went on much longer, and some of them just had to be cut way down as a result. Part of it is that the opening few minutes of a film, as you know, always kind of have to teach the audience how to watch the film. And so since we're trying to set up something that moves pretty fast and has a lot of characters, you kind of have to suggest that the film is going to be pretty light on its feet, and it's going to cover many different storylines before people get too invested in any one of them. And so the rhythm that we were trying to achieve was something where we were really cutting short, I think, a lot of those scenes. So you're kind of out by the time you have the bare minimum of information that you need to understand who this person is and to have some questions about them. And then you have to move on, because there just has to be that kind of momentum propelling you into the title.
Yeah, I love the idea that you mentioned that you have to teach the audience how to watch the film, because it certainly taught me, like, we're not really going to explain why these people are doing anything up front. It just happens. And so that's the way the rest of the film happens, too. Love it. There's a nice cut I loved on kicking down the door in West Texas to the guy waking up on the bus. I love that little moment. I'm assuming scripted, but right?
Thanks.
Did you have to play with the exact timing of, how that was going to happen?
Oh, yeah, of course. Actually, what was really funny was I think a lot of the stuff that happens by the door to the house as people are first starting to show up was some of the first material that they shot. And I think that there was actually maybe a little bit too much coverage in a way for a scene that is actually relatively simple. And so there were actually so many options that we ended up toying with that moment and a lot of the things that happened by the door of the house a bunch before we actually arrived at that cut. But I found it very satisfying. I mean, I like that energy that comes from a cut like that, where you're sort of cutting immediately on an action and somebody's reacting on the other side. It's like this, there's this transfer of energy through time and space that gets communicated through that cut.
Yeah. So you're saying that that was not scripted. There was stuff in between the door getting kicked and the guy waking up in the script.
I honestly don't remember.
Okay.
I think that was the order of scenes for sure. I'm not sure if that was intended to be the exact cut point. And as with many things in this film, I mean, I think this is a film where there are a lot of moments that propel you into different places or different times. And that's partly because of the ensemble nature of the film. There are several different threads during the actual heist operation. And then also there are these moments where you cut back on a moment of extreme tension into the backstory and get to meet the characters in their ordinary environments, kind of see their origin stories. And so a lot of that was actually scripted. I think that there was a lot of uncertainty around whether that would work or not. I mean, certainly when I read the script, I thought, this all sounds hypothetically great, but I don't really know if it's going to work. Everything's always hypothetical on the script level until you actually start cutting it together. And I guess it was not a surprise, but definitely relieving that so much of it worked as scripted. But as you know, I mean, even if it works structurally, getting the exact moment of those cuts right is incredibly difficult. And I think that one of the things that I focused on was really sharpening those kinds of moments and to punctuate them in exactly the right way, whether that's kicking in the door or cutting on an explosion or dropping a barrel. All of these things have to be timed exactly right. And so that's the sort of thing that you spend hours on, just finessing it and making sure that it's on the exact right frame.
There's a funeral that takes place in the movie. And in the scene after the funeral, kind of where people are gathered for whatever, a lunch or something, there's some great sound design under the conversation that takes place. Just some ominous, like distant mechanical refinery sound. Can you talk about using sound effects to build tension or create atmosphere?
Wow. Yeah. Thank you for bringing that up, because that is one of my favorite aspects of the film and not something that a lot of people have asked me about. But we had an incredible sound designer, Mike Odemark. And then we worked with a re-recording mixer, Rick Schnupp, who's also fantastic. And I think the sound was always going to be such a central part of the film, not only because that's how Daniel, the director, and I like to work in general. I mean, we think about sound an awful lot. But this is also a really interesting film in that respect, because the villain doesn't take on a human form in the film. The villain is really climate change. It's the oil industry. It's the infrastructure that they've built that is kind of the machinery of death. And the question is, how do you make that felt throughout the film? How do you make that ominous presence, this sort of foreboding sense, pervade the entire film, even when it's not visually represented a lot of the time? And so I think the sound design was shouldering a huge part of that burden of constructing the sense of this ongoing threat to human existence. And so we were thinking about, what does oil sound like when it's moving through the pipes? What does refinery sound like? And we didn't think about this in a very literal sense. It was much more about what emotionally feels right based on the kind of reaction we want the audience to have, which is an interesting contrast, I think, to the way that the rest of the sound design works. I mean, it's generally very grounded, very objective, and almost documentary-esque at times. But the presence of the oil and the oil industry is something where we took a little bit of a creative liberty with constructing these elaborate and ominous soundscapes.
Giving some props to your sound designer, which is lovely, and I'm sure that a lot of the heavy lifting was done by him. But what about you, before the sound designer comes in, are you feeling like you need to fill that scene with something to give it attention that gives you the pacing right? Or
yeah, absolutely. I really love working with sounds, just even when I'm constructing the rough assembly. I really feel like, especially in fiction films, there's just something about how bare and clean dialogue can sound when you don't back it up with any additional added sound. And I find that it really just makes the entire scene come alive. Even if you just add one track of ambience in a scene, it really does a lot to hold everything together, to smooth out any variation in audio quality, and really just to give you a sense of the place in which the action is occurring. So I always work with at least a little bit of sound design. And when it came to sections like the scene where they're standing outside of the refinery or where they're shutting down the oil traveling through the pipes, I was definitely focusing on creating at least some temp soundscapes for those sections. It was definitely not nearly as good as what Mike was able to construct later. It at least started a conversation. I think that for me, a big part of it is just providing something that other collaborators can react to. So I obviously care a great deal about the sound, while also recognizing that I'm never going to be as good as somebody who does that full time. They also, I think, respect and react to at least whatever I'm able to set forward at the very beginning.
I've talked to other people about the fact that sometimes either with sound design or with score, it actually allows you to change the pace of the scene. Either the sound design allows you, because it's creating so much tension, you can hold the scene longer, or maybe score comes in and you can tighten it because the score is telling you something that allows you to get out of the scene faster. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a great observation. I think that's absolutely true. I think it just has to do a lot with directing the audience's attention. And generally, if people's attention starts to wander, it's because you're not providing them with something that is stimulating enough to get them to think, you know, interesting thoughts. And that can come in so many different forms. It could come through the image. It could come through a plot development of some kind. And it could, of course, just be in the sound design. And if they're able to latch on to something in the sound and just marinate in the images for a little while, that allows you to alter the pace significantly.
There was another great cut that I wanted to talk to you about. Maybe you will remember, maybe not. Sean says, what do you know about building bombs? And there's this nice hard cut to Sean wiring a remote detonator. Was that scripted or found, or you just had to find the right moment?
That was in the scripts, though. Actually, that was a moment that changed, if I'm not mistaken. That was one of the scenes that we did in Pickups a little bit later. That first flashback that introduces both Sochi and Sean was one of the hardest parts of the film to get right, in part because, as with the opening of the film, how it has to teach you to watch the rest of the film, that first flashback has a lot riding on it because it has to establish the device of the flashback. People have to understand that that's kind of part of the structural conceit of the film, that you're going to be jumping out of the present tense, out of the active operation, and into each of the characters' backstories. And so there were a lot of things in that section that ended up changing up until the very end of the edit. And that scene, I guess, was one of them. So there was a lot of conversation, of course, about how that would unfold as they were preparing for Pickups. And that was something that was reacting to the edit, since we already had a rough cut by the time they went back to shoot that.
You mentioned the flashbacks. So for those who haven't seen the film, and I highly recommend that you do watch the film, you're following this heist, essentially, and you jump back to see the characters in their previous life to when this operation happens. Was there any thought of, or did you attempt to not put in the names or to do some other transition back into those flashbacks?
I'll be honest, I don't totally remember if we tried that. I do know that there was some question about which names we would showcase where, because often the characters' backstories end up overlapping in various ways. Many of these people are meeting for the first time during the heist operation itself, but many of them knew each other in advance. So sometimes the flashback will feature both Sochi and Alicia share a flashback together. And yet that flashback is labeled Alicia's flashback rather than Sochi's. And so there were those kinds of questions around, like, what does the audience expect based on the name that they see before the flashback?
That's interesting. No, that totally makes sense. After every single flashback, I think, has a text with the person's name, there's one that doesn't. I'm not disagreeing with your choice. I think that you had to have the person's name before the flashback, because otherwise it was very hard to tell, are we flashing back or are we still in the present? You don't know.
There are flashbacks where the name comes in the middle, as opposed to just at the very beginning of the flashback.
Right. So how were those choices made?
I think part of it was a comprehension issue. Like, one of the biggest issues is, does the audience understand that we're in a flashback? And I think that if you have a sufficiently different location, time of day, it becomes clear that you're not actually occupying the exact same space. It's not something that's just happening, you know, the next morning or something. So there has to be enough of a rupture, I think, in the continuity for people to understand that, Otherwise, you really do need the title at the beginning in order to establish that you're changing gears.
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought, because the one where I noticed that didn't have the title was going between day and a night scene that seemed a very different location. So you knew you had to be flashing back.
Right, right. Yeah, that makes sense. I think you're referring to the Logan and Rowan flashback much later in the film.
That was another interesting one, right? Because they're running in the operation and we cut to them running in the flashback.
Right. So I guess there are a couple of considerations there. Part of it is the question of comprehension and just do people understand where in time and space they are. But part of it, I think, is also a stylistic thing. Like that match cut from them running from behind in one scene to running from behind in another scene, I think was too good to pass up in a lot of ways. And there's something about, again, just thinking about the transfer of energy from one scene to the next. I think that that cut managed to keep the tension very high. Whereas I can imagine like cutting into a card there instead of cutting straight into the action would have kind of sucked the air out of it a little bit.
Yeah. Did you have coverage on that scene, the running scenes where you could have cut to two different angles and you chose to have the two angles match?
Yeah, I think that this was kind of by design. I think Daniel had kind of intended that we cut it this way. There were other options, so we did explore other things, but this was ultimately, I think, what the plan was and ultimately what worked best.
Another fun cut, and I love these jumps in time. I want you to talk about either whether this was scripted or whether it was another way to carry, like you said, carry energy from one scene to another, where they're all sitting around a campfire and one of the girls says, "I have handles if someone has mixers," and then boom, you cut to drunken laughter. You don't cut to somebody going and finding alcohol and people starting to drink. No, it's a big jump, energy to energy.
Yeah, exactly. I think that generally my idea is try to keep the audience doing at least some of the work all of the time. And if you give them too much and they know how the story goes, then they start to get ahead of the film, and that's a recipe for boredom. But I think that just the idea of a bunch of people sitting around and starting to drink is a story that's so familiar to so many people. You really don't need to do very much work for everybody to understand how one thing leads to another and suddenly everybody's drunk and sitting around in a room talking about terrorism.
Talk to me about the dynamics of quiet scenes compared to loud scenes and whether that was something, again, that you said you were given as a gift in the script because the script was written that way, or whether you needed to find those moments. For example, after the drunken terrorism talk, which is very loud and boisterous and the, you know, cuts between different people talking, and then that goes directly to Sochi out in the dark with the coyote sounds.
Well, actually, so this is another place where it was definitely helped by doing pickups. The scene of Sochi standing outside in the dark alone, smoking quietly, that was something that we added much later. And I think that there was a sense we had that to maintain the dynamism of the film, to really have this alternation between these really dense, frantic scenes of everybody sitting together and quieter moments of reflection, I think we just recognized the need for something of that sort to happen in that moment. And so that was actually one of the last things we shot. It may very well be the very last thing that we shot and put into the film. In a film like this, people often tell me about how unrelenting it is and how tense it is throughout. But I think that a big part of that is actually about building in pauses, building in breath, because people actually start to tune out if they are literally experiencing tension all the way through. It just kind of all starts to run together and become the same. And so you actually have to build in these moments where the audience really can just catch their breath. And it's the contrast between the tension and the moments of rest that I think creates the sense of constant tension.
Yeah. You used that word at the beginning of that answer, dynamism. You are trying to build in a roller coaster of ups and downs and fasts and slows. That is what dynamism means, right? That's how you used it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think a big part of that is also being able to layer the different characters' perspectives as well. I mean, part of it is that when you have a room full of people and you're kind of jumping between every person's perspective, you start to get a sense of the group dynamic. But ultimately, what the audience feels, I think, has to come through individual characters' perspectives. Although that changes so many times over the course of the film, moments like Sochi standing alone and smoking give you an opportunity to latch on to one character's perspective and really develop an emotional attachment to what's going to happen later in the film.
as you mentioned, there's an operation going on, and at one point, half the team, or most of the team, is doing one thing, and then two of the team goes away. Can you talk about intercutting those two simultaneous things that are happening, and whether that was exactly scripted, or did you find moments where we need to get away from this for one reason or another and go to that?
This is another instance in which I honestly don't remember what was scripted and what wasn't.
Yeah.
I think for me, so much of the challenge of making this film was actually just wrapping my head around the structure of it at first. I mean, ultimately, the script is kind of a blueprint that suggests how things might be put together. But behind that, there is an imagined actual operation that's unfolding. And so I sort of needed to understand just for myself, what is even going on in this heist? Like, what is each character doing at any given moment? How in the imagined reality of the film do all of these things unfold simultaneously? And so I actually used Miro, if you're familiar with that, sort of an online index carding outlining software to map out in great detail the timeline of the entire film. And that was actually one of the first things that I did in the edit, just grabbing screenshots from each of the scene and plotting out the real chronology of the film, what was happening for each person at each moment. And that gave me kind of the freedom to change the order where I saw fit or where it was necessary, because at least I could understand what I was trying to represent and understand what the script was trying to get at, which was actually, I think, much more complex and better thought out than I think anyone would actually realize. One of the marks of a successful script is that you can kind of just read it and experience the emotions of it without understanding all of the nuts and bolts, everything that went into planning out exactly why things happen in that order. But I needed to understand for myself how the writers had made those decisions. And I didn't always have Daniel and Jordan and Ariella in the editing room to explain to me exactly why they had chosen to do things in a certain way. So it was a little bit of homework for me just to figure out, how do you thread together all of these different simultaneous events?
I love that you used Miro to do that. Is there a reason why you didn't use real index cards, or is that just because you're half my age at least?
No, I like real index cards a lot too. I think it was just that this was such a complicated story in so many ways. And I just wanted to have a level of granularity that I think would have been very difficult to pull off with real index cards. I mean, without a wall that was, you know, 50 feet long or something. And this is New York, not LA. So I don't have that kind of space. But also, I'm happy to show you that. I'm happy to send as a visual aid or something.
Tell me about score. It's kind of atonal. What did you use for temp? Were you able to interact with the composer during the edit? Anything you can talk about score?
I love talking about the score for this film because Gavin Bervik, the composer, is both a dear friend and a repeat collaborator. And I think we have a really fulfilling dynamic when we get to work together. Gavin also composed the score for Cam, which is Daniel Goldhaber's first feature that they also cut. And during that process, we kind of developed this way of passing things back and forth where the cut was constantly responding to the music and the music was responding to the cut. And I think that that really continued in this project. So Gavin actually went to New Mexico where they were shooting and recorded a bunch of sounds in the fields, people banging on oil drums or just sounds of nature. And so Gavin had this incredible library of sounds that he could draw from. And he used those to basically make these artificial instruments in the computer that he then used to start building out these bizarre textures that sort of fell somewhere between sound design and music. That was kind of the first music that I started temping with. I put together the first cut of the film without any music at all, in part because I knew that in a film that just has so much inherent tension, I really needed to know that I was doing my job effectively as an editor and not just leaning on the music to supply the tension. But after that first cut, I started drawing on these sketches that Gavin had put together and layering in a lot of his music. There were some moments when we were using temp. We used things like Tangerine Dream, in part because Michael Mann's films are such a huge reference point for us, and Tangerine Dream's scores for Michael Mann are incredible. So we were drawing on that. Fortunately, we didn't use very much temp music. That disappeared relatively quickly because Gavin was working from the very beginning constantly and supplying me with new music. Gavin essentially composed the score twice, I think, because I had been using a lot of his music. And then as we got closer to Picture Lock, it just became clear that there were certain sections that would require something different. And I think in particular about the beginning of day two of the film, which is essentially the beginning of the actual operation itself. Everybody gets up, they're a little bit hungover, they drink their coffee, and they set out to actually do the deed. Gavin composed a piece of music that I think was 11 minutes long, like one continuous cue, which was such a feat of composing. And it's also the sort of thing that doesn't work unless you're really working hand in hand as composer and editor.
Early in our discussion, we'd mentioned how sometimes adding score can change the pace of a scene. So, and you just said that you cut without score and then you added the score later. Did that happen? Did you find a scene with his score now was too long or too short?
Yeah, I think that it really depended on the piece of music too, though. I think score can sometimes elongate things and it can sometimes make them shorter. And your perception of time is like so unpredictable in those instances, at least I find. There were moments when I really wanted to build out some of these long pauses. And sometimes what that would require from Gavin was something very different, like a very sparse cue, a moment that's very tense and that requires a lot of patience on the part of the audience. Sometimes also requires a piece of music that's a little atonal, a little hard to anticipate, not something that's too rhythmic. And then at times when you want things to move a lot faster, like at the beginning of the heist operation, you're drawing on music that is way more propulsive and maybe has a driving beat. And so those sorts of things, I think, can radically change the perception of time. But I also think that it's really hard to separate out the effects of the music and just generally what your feelings are about that scene. I think that it's kind of all working in tandem, like understanding that certain scenes just need to come down more generally, and also wanting to use the music to accentuate the tension.
We were discussing kind of intercutting. When the other thing that you're intercutting is between when we're in this operation, which I think we can say, since it's in the title of the film, How to Blow Up a Pipeline. We're not giving away too much. When you're cutting between this operation of blowing up the pipeline or attempting to, and these flashbacks, are you also having to find the right moment to get into and out of those two things? And can you think of any time when you were like, it's in the script to do this, but I think we should cut out these four lines because it'll make a better edit to go from the flashback here to the operation here?
I think for getting out of the flashbacks, it was a lot more challenging than getting into the flashbacks. I think most of the cuts into the flashbacks were more or less as scripted from the outset. And I think that that's a great testament to the writer's ability to anticipate our needs. I think cutting out of the flashbacks was a little bit tougher because I think sometimes scenes just had a tendency to overstay their welcome. When you think about trying to maintain the momentum and trying to build up the energy going back into the tension of the heist operation, it often really helps to get out of a scene as early as possible. I mean, generally speaking, it's better to get out of a scene sooner rather than later. But sometimes even just maintaining the sense of almost clipping a scene, I think is really helpful for creating that sense of energy and then also disorientation sometimes, going into the present tense again, which can actually be very helpful. If you disorient the audience a little bit and they're casting about for something to grab onto, and then that quickly presents itself, I think that there's just a subtle way in which that allows the audience to change gears more easily. So one example of this, I guess, there was one particularly explosive cut out of a flashback and into the present tense where the character doesn't even get to finish their line before the cut happens. I think sometimes the audience is really expecting a scene to play out in full for a character to finish their line, but actually they've gotten a lot of the material that they need to understand the scene already. Like on an emotional level, perhaps they already understand what the ultimate takeaway of that scene is. And so even cutting out in the middle of the line doesn't necessarily hurt anyone's ability to understand what's happening, but it does maintain the momentum. And so that sort of surprise, I think, is a great thing to aim for.
Yeah. Talk about the macro pacing of the movie. If, you know, as you are trying to decide how long the movie should be, when you're going to hit certain points, like you mentioned, how long should we be before we get to the opening titles? How long should it take us to get to them arriving at their objective? Each one of those is a big question that is probably different from your original cut to the way the movie ended up.
There are probably a lot of people who are much better than I am at thinking about specific targets that they want to hit in terms of duration or what percentage of the film should be in one space rather than another. But that's generally not really how I approach things. It's much more intuitive, I think, just in terms of feeling like, well, maybe we've overstayed our welcome in this section of the film, or I really feel like we have to get to this moment sooner. But what exactly that means, I think, can vary wildly from one project to the next. So I'm not really thinking in terms of specific plot points or like, I don't know, three act structure or something like that. And I think on a film like this in particular, where so much of it is just, it's mostly just about maintaining the tension. I think that that's really the primary objective throughout the film, is maintain the tension. When you go into the flashback, don't spend too long away from the main operation, or else people will lose some of the momentum within the heist itself. Everything had to be in service of just maintaining that forward momentum. There were versions of the film in which we spent a lot more time in day one. Day one is the time when the crew is getting their bombs ready. They're scoping out the locations. They're basically laying all of the preparatory work for the heist itself, but not actually doing the thing. There were some versions of that that were significantly longer, in part because Jordan, one of the writers, and I think, are very drawn to stories that have a lot of process. And so a lot of that process stuff was allowed to unfold in a little bit more detail with a little bit more duration. And I think that we realized over time that the whole thing just felt a little bit too slack when we spent too much time in those sections of the film. And so there was this process of whittling that down until it was to a point when we felt like we weren't shortchanging the sort of documentary reality of watching people go through the labor of making these bombs. But we were also maintaining a lot of the momentum that was getting shortchanged by the previous iteration of the film.
I wasn't looking for percentages, but exactly what you said, that when you're watching something, there's an intuitive sense of, we need to get to the day two faster than this.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we did just have a sense sometimes that there were certain moments that needed to arrive sooner than we were providing them. And part of that was the audience can only go for so long without understanding why these characters are doing what they're doing or how they got to do what they're doing. And so the first flashback, I think, needed to arrive sooner than it originally did. Part of the work was cutting down some of the process leading up to flashback one so that people could get a bit of a foothold from the perspective of character before the rest of the film unfolded. So it's more about giving the audience exactly what they need in order to develop the emotional attachments that make the film a rewarding experience. And if you withhold for too long, then people start to tune out. I have a teacher who often referred to these as chiropractic issues, where there's a problem in one place and then you feel it, say, 30 minutes later. And so often it would be problems with the emotional reaction to the end of the film. But in reality, it's a problem at the very beginning of the film, where people are actually not developing the right kind of emotional investment on a character level.
The film was shot on 16 millimeter film. Is that true?
Yeah, it was shot by Tahila De Castro, who's a phenomenal DP. And she really specializes in shooting on 16. I think that that was a decision that they made very early on in the process, not only because I think we all just love the look of film, but also because in those kinds of conditions where you're shooting out in the desert in broad daylight, digital, I think, suffers a lot more than film. Film, I think, handles just the harshness of those conditions in a much more elegant way.
Love it. What did it mean for you in the edit?
In the edit, what that meant was that I was operating with kind of a delay. I mean, ideally, I think a lot of editors like to review footage as it's being shot. And that wasn't entirely possible for me because they would shoot in New Mexico, FedEx the footage to Photocam in LA. And then I was in New York in my office with my great assistant editor, Emily Yu. And because they could only ship the footage every few days, I would only get the footage, you know, sometimes like 5 days after it had been shot. So there was a little bit of a delay in terms of my ability to review the footage and then provide timely feedback to the people on set. But we did have a way of getting around that problem, which was that Jordan was one of the writers of the film, but he was also on set and doing all sorts of odd jobs. One of his jobs was basically to operate this recorder that was hooked up to the video tap in the camera. And so he would record basically what looks like this really crappy view through the viewfinder, and then send those as basically low quality dailies to me at the end of every day. So I would actually have an opportunity to review, at least without sound, what they had shot that day. And just to be able to say, it looks like you're getting enough coverage of this. Maybe you spent a little bit too much time on this one scene, whatever the case may be. And I think that part of the challenge a lot of the time for the director is you know, you're out there in these really difficult conditions, fighting the elements, fighting for light in the middle of the winter. Often it really helps to just have an editor be able to provide pretty immediate feedback and say, hey, you're getting great material. Don't freak out. Don't worry about this at all. Keep up the good work. And I mean, of course, I'm being totally honest with him, but in truth, he was getting material that I thought was great. And it would have been very difficult to be that kind of emotional support from afar if I had not been able to review things until a week later.
From a technical standpoint, what were you getting from Photochem? Were they giving you proxies, or were they giving you the, were you editing with the actual high resolution, whatever, 4K, 2K scans?
Photochem was giving us proxies. We were cutting with those proxies, and then we relinked to the source footage, like the full res scans, when we did the online.
And what were you cutting in? Premiere, Avid?
I was cutting in Premiere. That's sort of been my go-to over the past several years. Basically, since Premiere introduced Productions, that's really been my favorite program.
Talk to me about the use of Productions, because I think that that is a big turning point for Premiere and its ability to handle something like a feature-length film. Explain why you felt like that was the turning point for you.
Yeah, I think I've cut features in both Avid and Premiere, and I've cut in Premiere with Productions and without Productions. And my feeling was, one of the things that Avid does so well is it has all this modularity with the bin structure, where you open up one file and it doesn't mean to open up every single thing in your project. You just open up the relevant bins, which I think reduces the load on the machine significantly. And when Premiere introduced Productions, I think it was their direct answer to that. And it just became so much more stable when editing a long form project. I think for me, the big question is, what is the software that I'm fastest in? And I just find that I'm faster at cutting things in Premiere for whatever reason. I just think that it's a lot more intuitive for me. And so there was this trade-off before of, well, am I gaining something in stability while losing a little bit of speed on the keyboard? Now I think that I don't really have to make that compromise. Now I think it's really stable. I wasn't experiencing any crashes in Premiere while I was cutting this. And I think that just being able to move very quickly through changes makes it a lot more feasible to kind of sit with the director and then just audition basically every idea, rather than arguing for several minutes about whether something is going to work or not. You can kind of just try it out. Even if it's in a relatively rough version, you can see enough to say, maybe this is a direction that's worth pursuing, or maybe we shouldn't go down this path and should try something else.
I've cut features in every NLE. Actually, I have not done a Premiere film with Productions. Anything to the organization of using Productions that you needed to get used to, or that you particularly loved or hated?
There really wasn't much to adjust to when it came to Productions. Just at least from my perspective, organizationally, it was very similar to just structuring a normal project, be it in Avid or Premiere. It's just that I think under the hood, there's a lot more that's occurring there to keep things stable and modular. It was very intuitive. I think that the only thing that was a challenge on a technical level was figuring out how to manage mirroring our drives. So I've actually worked with Emily now on two projects, and we've used Productions in two different configurations. On Pipeline, we were using mirrored drives. We had these tiny 4 terabyte SSDs that just had all the proxies on them. And that kept me very mobile, which I loved because I could kind of cut from wherever. We did have an office, but I could kind of take the project on the go with me. One time when we did a test screening in LA, I was exporting the film on my laptop from the back seat of a cab across town. So it was really nice to be able to stay that flexible. And then on our more recent project together, we were using a shared server within the office. And so I've found that one of the other things that's been great about Productions is just seeing how it can exist in so many different configurations, depending on the budget and the needs of the specific production.
Daniel, I project a long and fruitful career for you, and it was a great project to watch, and it was a pleasure to talk to you about it.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad that you enjoyed it, and it's always a pleasure to talk about films, and especially a pleasure to talk with other editors.
That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, if you'd prefer to read this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors for a topic-driven curated look at the craft of editing. Thanks to Daniel Garber for discussing how to blow up a pipeline. Thanks also to our partner, Boris FX. Be sure to check them out at borisfx.com. I'm Steve Hallfish, ACE. Thanks for listening, and please tell all the editors and filmmakers that you know that to get more great Art of the Cut interviews every week, please subscribe on your favorite podcast app. And if you want a good follow on socials, I'm on Twitter and Instagram as @SteveHallfish.